Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with How Stuff Works and iHeartRadio, and I love all things tech. And you know, sometimes here on the show, I can get a little salty, which is why we're looking at this classic episode, Tech Stuff Gets Salty, and originally published on October 1st, 2012. And, you know, I'm being all coy and everything. But yes, this is an episode that's about desalination, the process of removing salt from water, and the technology behind it. I hope you enjoy this classic episode. So, Chris, one of the big issues facing the world today is access to clean, drinkable water.
That's true.
And so we wanted to talk to someone who's an expert in a particular form of processing water to make something that isn't drinkable into drinkable water. And we have with us from GE, Eric Hansen. Eric, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much.
We're excited to have you here, and we're going to talk a bit about desalination, which is a process where we're removing things like salt and other minerals from water so that you have clean drinking water as a byproduct, really. Mm-hmm. The other one being the solute. So we wanted to talk a little bit about the process that you guys use over at GE, the things that you're looking into, and how that has changed over the years. So to really start off, what are the greatest benefits of desalination?
It's a great question. The world today faces, ever-increasing challenges and stresses on water supplies. But the good news behind that is the Earth's surface is 70% water. So even though less than 1% of that is accessible as fresh water today, the rest of it is seawater, and we do have the technologies today to turn that into usable water. So, in fact, those technologies have been around for a really long time. Even hundreds of years ago, people would boil water, capture the steam from that water, and use the condensation from that steam as purified water. So the concepts of desalinating water using heat or thermal technologies, those aren't new concepts. They've been around for a while. Desalination's been going on for a long time, and even up through most of the 90s, thermal technologies were still very prevalent, albeit a little bit more advanced than just simply boiling water, but the concepts were still the same: heating up the water, capturing the steam, and condensing it.
Sure.
So in the 90s, different technologies started being applied. Instead of heating up the water and boiling it, what we started doing was applying membranes, special kinds of very advanced filters. These membranes are able to remove the salts from the water with much less energy. It takes a lot of energy to boil water. So using membrane technologies, we've been able to reduce the amount of energy it takes to remove the salt from water. And over the last 20 years, there have been just a lot of advances in that field, which I'm sure we'll go into a little bit more in our conversation.
Sure.
And it's making the cost of desalinating water come down, every year.
Right. And so you're talking about these semi-permeable membranes. Essentially, we're looking at a process of reverse osmosis, really, using pressure, essentially, to force water that has various minerals and salt in it through this membrane. The membrane separates out the minerals, the salts, and the water passes through. Normally, when you have a membrane between a solute and a solvent, the solvent is going to pass through the membrane until there's an equilibrium there, and osmotic pressure is built up. So in this case, we're actually applying energy on one side so that we get water on one end of the membrane and everything else is on the other. Is that sort of a bird's eye view of what that technology is all about?
Yeah, you described it very well. One of the biggest difference between membrane filtration and the types of filtration that most people are familiar with is when most people think of a filter, they imagine a barrier of some kind with one stream of water flowing into it,
mm-hmm.
things being removed by that barrier, and then one stream of water flowing out the other side. And then after a while, you have to do something to get all the stuff you've removed off that barrier.
Mm-hmm.
So membrane technology doesn't exactly work that way. You still have a barrier, and it's the membrane. But in membrane technology, the feed stream is actually flowing across the membrane. So you have one stream in, but then you're applying pressure. So some water is making it through the membrane, and that's the purified water without much salt in it. And all the salt is staying on the other side of the membrane. So in membrane technology, instead of one stream in and one stream out, you actually have one stream in but two streams out.
Oh.
The purified stream and the saltier stream.
So that saltier stream, the brine, I know that that has caused some problems in the past simply because brine, you know, what do you do with that after you've gone through the desalination process? Now, brine, because it has this concentrated amount of salts and minerals in it, it's actually denser than seawater. So if you were to simply dump that brine into the sea, then it would sink to the bottom of the sea floor where it could potentially cause damage depending upon the environment that you're in. Can you talk a little bit about some of the approaches to take care of that problem? I know there's some about mixing the brine in with other water that's going to be running into the sea so it dilutes it.
Sure. So, I mean, if you step back and look at the desalination process, you know, from 30,000 feet,
mm-hmm.
It can simply be considered really part of the normal water cycle, the hydrological cycle. So, yes, there's water with more salt going back into the ocean, but the water that's purified and is then used, ultimately that goes back into the ocean as well, whether it comes through, you know, municipal wastewater and sanitary sewers and is treated, you know, in many other ways. You know, that water all does essentially return to the hydrological cycle at some point. So, you know, from a high level, the mass balance is fine. The oceans aren't going to get saltier because of this,
mm-hmm.
because we are returning the purified water back to the oceans at some point as well. So really the more immediate concern is just that very point at which you're introducing the brine back into the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the characteristics of the seabed and what's living in that area, sometimes there are special considerations that are taken. And, you know, there are many different ways you can return the brine back into the ocean. You can just have a pipe that puts it right into the ocean. You can create an elaborate grid of pipes underneath the seabed to blend it a little bit better. There's a number of different methods, and even though desalination may seem like a niche to some people, there are actually quite a few specialties within it, and, you know, really thinking through how the brine is going back into the ocean and how it's going to affect marine life is quite a science in itself. But, you know, there's been a ton of progress on that really in just the last 10 years. And, you know, I think in nearly all cases, we're now able to come up with special schemes and the right technology to blend it without harming marine life.
Fantastic. Hey there, it's Jonathan from 2019. We're going to take a break from this salt extravaganza and hear from our sponsor. Well, moving on to another question. What's the greatest barrier to adoption of desalination? I mean, why... what's keeping this technology from being more widespread and used in more areas of the world?
You know, I think there are, you know, you could probably classify it into two different barriers. One of them is more perception. You know, there are some areas where the public still isn't really that on board with it yet, just for, you know, things they've read in the news and their own ideas about it. Other parts of the world are doing this often, you know, in the Middle East or in Southeast Asia, you find desal plants all over the place. They have largely solved all the environmental issues that people should be worried about. You know, but some people are slower to adapt than others, and it takes a while to come to terms with some of that mentally. So that, you know, that's a harder problem to solve. The easier problems to solve really are the energy problems, because when you do desalination, it isn't the cheapest way to get water. If there's other supplies of water available to you, that don't have so much salt in them, they're most likely going to be less expensive than desalination. So today people are doing desalination really only in areas where they don't have a lot of other alternatives, where they're in a water scarce area and they simply need to do it. So driving down the energy cost is really the primary goal in desalination, and it has been for the last 20 years. And there have been a lot of different improvements over the last really 15 years that have really made progress in driving that down, and they're in a number of different areas. Obviously, the amount of energy that you need to drive the salt out of the water is a big deal, and you can lower that through advances in the membrane chemistry, so actually improving the membranes. You can do it through advances in the efficiencies of pumps, and you can also do it through advances in energy recovery devices. So there's a number of different areas that people are working on. And then in addition to that, you know, simply the operation of these plants, you know, it requires a fair amount of manpower just to keep these things running. So we've also been making a lot of improvements and innovations in the pretreatment to these plants. So as the pretreatment to the water gets better, there are lower operating costs as well. So lots of different levers to pull in order to lower the operating costs.
You know, I was wondering a little bit about the equipment itself. I mean, the process itself seems pretty straightforward. But you know, is the equipment itself large? Does it take up a lot of space, or does it require a lot of high pressure to make it work?
Yeah, two different things. In terms of size, it doesn't take up really any more space than a traditional water treatment plant for the same capacity would.
Mm-hmm.
But the big difference is pressure. The more salt that you have dissolved in any given amount of water, the higher the osmotic pressure of that water, something Jonathan referred to in his earlier explanation.
Right.
So the more salt, the higher the osmotic pressure, the more pressure you need to apply to the water to drive the salt out of it. So take, for example, the Middle East. In the Gulf in the Middle East, that's really some of the saltiest water in the world. So on desal plants there, we're running them as high as 800 or 850 PSI, which is pretty high pressure.
Mm-hmm.
In other parts of the world, like say the Caribbean, the water is a little less salty, still absolutely seawater, but it's not quite as saline as the Middle East. So there because it has slightly less salt, you can use slightly less pressure.
Now, are these plants often sort of piggybacked on to other plants like power generation? I was wondering if there was a lot of cogeneration going on with desalination plants.
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is actually one of the reasons that GE is you know, so active in this market. You know, there's just an there's a obvious tie between energy and water. So to produce energy, you know, power plants need water to produce energy. In fact, almost 10% of all global water withdrawals go to the production of water. So that's a pretty significant amount. And then the reverse of that is to desalinate water, you need energy to do it. So power plants and desal plants are very linked. In the past, when the technologies were more thermal-based, that was another advantage of tying the plants together, because many power plants, especially power plants in the past, had a lot of waste heat, so they could use some of that heat for the thermal desalination. Power plants today are much more efficient, so there isn't so much waste heat coming from them.
Mm-hmm.
And the membrane technologies come to a point where really that's the prevalent technology for desalination. So we're not seeing them tied together as much anymore because of waste heat from the power plant, but we are seeing them tied together simply because the power plant needs water, and the desal plant needs power.
Excellent. Hi, it's Jonathan from 2019 again. I decided that I needed to get a little salt, so I came back to visit this episode. While I'm doing that, let's take another quick break. So what is GE doing to make desalination more feasible to address water scarcity issues?
So we're working in a number of different areas. We've worked a lot in the past on the membranes, and You know, there are really some very high-quality membranes now used in desalination. They're not at entitlement yet. There are still some gains to be made there, but they're getting close. The membranes are very efficient today. Pretreatment is very important. So when we talk about membranes and how they take the salt out of water, they're great at taking the salt out of water, but they aren't great at taking suspended solids out of water. Mm. So you don't want to put salt or sticks or stones or anything like that into a membrane. That's bad for it. So pretty much every membrane plant in the world has some kind of pretreatment in front of it to take the suspended solids out before it gets to the membranes. And GE's been leading in this area as well. We have some terrific advanced prefiltration. Another type of membrane called an ultrafiltration membrane, and it provides really superior suspended solids removal so that the water that gets to the reverse osmosis membranes is as clean as it can be. Still salty, but it's had everything else removed, and that makes the life of those membranes last a lot longer, which in turn lowers the overall cost of ownership. Then the other piece is the pumping side. There are a lot of different kinds of pumps in the marketplace. The most efficient types of pumps are positive displacement pumps. If you think of pumping water, you can imagine you have a fixed geometry of water. The most efficient way to raise the pressure of it is just to push on it. And that works today in relatively small sizes, but as plants get larger and larger, there aren't so many good positive displacement pumps. So instead, what people use are centrifugal pumps. So that's more like spinning the water.
Mm-hmm.
The water that gets thrown to the outside has a higher pressure. So, you know, we've been working, developing a new pump, which is a positive displacement style pump, but it's much larger than other positive displacement style pumps on the marketplace. That's a pretty new product for us, but we expect that within the next year, we're going to start seeing more of that pump out in desal plants. And that's going to knock as much as another 10% of the energy off. So that when we get that fully commercialized and out in the marketplace, it's going to lower the electrical cost by about 10% more, which is really significant when you're talking about you know, the cost of desalination.
Sure. So that sort of leads into, what do you see as the future of desalination? Where do you see us going in another few years, like another decade or two decades?
Yeah, that's a great question and a hard question, because there are many, many technologies out there today. You know, I think most people in the industry, myself included, really see reverse osmosis as continuing to be the most prevalent technology for at least the next 5 or 7 or 10 years. It's certainly possible that some other technologies could come along, and, you know, honestly, if there are other technologies that will dramatically lower the cost of desalination, that would be great for the planet. But I, you know, I think over the next 5 or 7 years, what we're going to see is people figuring out how to link desal plants more to other renewables. So already we're starting to see people thinking about, how do you combine a desal plant with wind turbines and a wind farm? Or how do you combine a desal plant with a solar farm? You know, it turns out that a lot of places in the world that need desalination, places that are water scarce, are also places that have quite a bit of sun.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some nice natural links between, you know, combining solar with desal in some ways. There's also challenges because, you know, in addition to having a lot of sun, you know, some of these places also have a lot of sand, and it's dusty, and dust and solar don't always pair so well. The dust coats the panels, and they become less efficient. But, you know, now we're talking about some pretty discrete challenges. You know, people are doing this now. They're learning. They're getting better at it. There's not a lot of solar plus desal or wind plus desal out there today. But I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we're probably going to start to see a lot more of that.
Yeah, it's really exciting. And to give our listeners an idea of the impact that these sort of technologies have made so far, it wasn't that long ago that the estimated population that could not get access to clean water was around 20%. But according to the World Health Organization, they had a 2012 report which took numbers from 2010 and took a look at that. They said that it's still a massive problem. Still 780 million people lack access to safe drinking water, according to this report. And that's a sobering number, but the silver lining here is that that's half of what it was before. So that the numbers of people who are getting access to safe drinking water, they're on the rise, which, I mean, that's obviously the way we want to see this trend go. So it's exciting to see this sort of technology combined with the efforts of other organizations out there dedicated to making sure that people across the world get access to this water.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, one of the statistics that I often hear is that today it's one in every six people today doesn't have access to clean water, which is, you know, as you said, really a sobering number. You know, I think there's an interesting combination here where you read a lot about this today. You know, 10 years ago, you didn't generally see water articles in mainstream media. And today, you know, every week you're going to see an article in mainstream media talking about water scarcity. And, you know, it is a serious problem and it is alarming. But the plus side of this publicity is that there are more entrepreneurs, more large companies like GE, just more people out there starting to think about what are some possible solutions. And there's lots of them. You know, desalination is a great example of ways that we can solve water scarcity. Water reuse is another great example of ways that we can solve water scarcity. You know, water reuse is just taking water that's already been used for one purpose and treating it and cleaning it up and finding a way to use it for another purpose. So, you know, I think all the current press that we hear about water scarcity is actually helping to feed a pipeline of new innovations and new ideas that will actually help solve the problem in the long run.
Fantastic. Eric, that's a great look at the desalination process and what GE is doing to really push this technology forward. And we really appreciate you coming on the show and talking with us. It's been a really educational experience for me. And especially as liberal arts majors whose background in engineering is saying, wow, that's cool. It's really great to get people like you on our show to talk about this and give our listeners this sort of look. Is there anything else you would like to say before we wrap up?
Well, Jonathan, Chris, I'd just like to say thanks. Thanks for having me on the show. You know, at GE, we're doing a lot of really interesting and innovative things to solve the very problems that we were just talking about for the last half hour. You know, one of the great things about being in this kind of business is when you come up with innovations, you can actually see that they're helping people. So, you know, it's a rewarding business to be in. GE is very committed to it. We're investing a lot in solving problems today and in the future. I love talking about it, and I'm really excited about where this can all go over the next couple of years.
And that wraps up this classic episode of Tech Stuff, where we learned all about desalination. There's been a lot more work on that over the last few years, and maybe I'll do a follow-up episode to talk about this and the challenges around desalination and how we need to really be cognizant of those challenges before we pursue desalination on a grand scale. It turns out it's a lot more complicated than just taking salt out of water. I hope you guys enjoyed the episode. If you have suggestions for future topics for Tech Stuff, feel free to reach out to me. The email address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com. Or pop on over to our website. That's techstuffpodcast.com. You will find links to all of our old episodes. I say old, I should say classic, gorgeous, pristine episodes. And you will also find links to where we are on social media. And you'll find a link to our online store where every purchase you make goes to help the show. And we greatly appreciate it. And I'll talk to you again really soon. Tech Stuff is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.